Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I Aim at the Stars was a 1960 film about Dr. Wernher von Braun, a former member of the Nazi Party, who would make NASA's dream of putting a man on the moon possible. Well, NASA now actually is aiming at a star, our star, the sun. This summer, they'll be launching a spacecraft towards the sun to conduct tests in its atmosphere, something they've never done before because, as Icarus found out, it gets a little hot out there. Here to tell us more about NASA's moment in the sun, as well as other short subjects in science, is Sarah Kaplan, science writer for The Washington Post. Sarah, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, good to be here.
So NASA gets to check mission to the sun off its bucket list soon, is that right?
Yeah, this is actually something the agency has wanted to do since the 50s, like basically since it was founded. And it wasn't possible because, as you mentioned, it gets really hot up there. But now, because of advances in science and also advances in technology, they finally managed to build a spacecraft that's capable of withstanding this really intense heat. So we're headed this summer.
Did you actually get to see this the shield on the spacecraft?
Yeah, so the spacecraft is right now being tested and put together at Goddard Space Flight Center. And I got to go into the clean room where they're kind of putting it all together right before it went into a thermal testing chamber. So it's this like big empty warehouse space, and you have to be really careful when you go in that you don't accidentally contaminate the spacecraft.
So you didn't contaminate it at all?
This is where I confess that I actually sneezed while I was in the clean room. So hopefully, I sneezed away from the spacecraft. Hopefully, none of my mucus is going to cause a problem for this mission that's 60 years in the making.
I think the solar radiation will kind of sterilize all that away.
Yeah, hopefully.
Tell us what kind of tests they're going to be doing in the sun's atmosphere.
So there's a, even though the sun is sort of right there, it's this like huge thing in our sky, it's actually a pretty mysterious place. And there are two kind of big questions that NASA wants to answer. The first is something that called the solar wind, which is the stream of charged particles that goes at supersonic speed, so faster than the speed of sound, comes sort of blasting out of the sun, and it goes all the way to the edge of our solar system. And we don't really understand kind of how it gets sped up so fast or where it's coming from. So that's one question that they're trying to answer. And then the other is the atmosphere of the sun is actually hotter than the surface of the sun by about 300 times hotter, wow, which is like if you went up into the stratosphere and you were suddenly boiling. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And so that's another like really big mystery that NASA is going to be trying to solve.
Yeah, well, that's kind of interesting. All right, up next, scientists have discovered, there's news this week, the oldest human remains outside of Africa, and there were tools nearby. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is this jawbone from a human, Homo sapiens, that was discovered in this cave in Israel. And most human, the earliest known human remains before this were about 100,000, maybe 120,000 years old outside Africa, which is where our species originated. But these ones are 177 to as old as 194,000 years old, so like 50,000 years older. And that's a big surprise because we just didn't think that Homo sapiens was so adventurous that early in our history. And they've also got these cool tools nearby that are, they're a very special processing technique called Levallois, which means that you kind of have to like, it's kind of like a, where the way a sculptor sees the sculpture inside a stone before he starts carving, you have to be able to see the point that you want to make in a like given piece of rock before you start sort of chipping it away to make the tool that you want. And that requires, you know, sophisticated intellect, because you have to be able to see into the future. So that indicates that these guys were, you know, pretty smart.
Wow. But does it mean we're pushing back the timeline for when humans migrated out of Africa?
Not necessarily. I mean, it means that we're adventuring out of Africa earlier, but that those adventures might not have lasted very long. If you look at the DNA of modern people from Asia and Europe and the Americas, our genetics trace back to about 60 to 70,000 years ago. And so that was kind of the final migration that allowed humans to push out of Africa and colonize the world. So most of our sort of evolution and development probably still happened in the African continent.
Let's move on to our next story, because it's hard to believe. It's been two decades since Dolly the sheep, but now Chinese researchers have cloned a pair of macaque monkeys.
Mm-hmm. So instead of Dolly the sheep, you've got Zong Zong and Hua Hua, two cute little monkeys that were cloned using this new technique, or it's the same technique as Dolly the sheep, where you basically you take a nucleus from the individual you want to clone, and that has all of its genetic material in it, and then you plug it into an egg cell, and that will develop into an embryo.
I remember when we covered Dolly the sheep on Science Friday, it was such wow, cutting-edge news. Now it's sort of like ho-hum. They did a couple of, you know, macaques. What else are they going to do tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, we've done it for a few species, and actually this technique has been used just for medical research on some human cells. So it is kind of, you know, it's people have been working on it for a while. And the only reason it took so long with these monkeys is that there's a lot of sort of epigenetic factors in development that you have to consider. So for each individual species, you have to know exactly the right treatment for the embryo to get it to develop into a little tiny monkey.
And no one is saying this is leading to human cloning at this point.
No. It's. I mean, the objective for this is more for medical research and basic research. We are a long way off, if ever, from human clones.
Well, we'll have to keep checking in about the health of those two, because it's a long run to see, you know, how well they actually do.
But Dolly wasn't too bad, so hopefully they will fare well too.
Yeah. And finally, it's a new year, which means the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has moved the doomsday clock closer to midnight.
Yeah, so the I mean, every year
it's not a good thing, is it?
No, if you needed some existential dread going into the weekend, here it is. Because of sort of developments in nuclear weapons and also humanity's sort of continued inaction on climate change, the bulletin has decided that we are now 30 seconds closer to midnight than we were last year. And this is actually the closest we've ever been since the height of the Cold War, and since 1953. So the situation is pretty dire.
I'm pulling out my Fallout Shelter manual and my duck and cover old videos.
Yeah, stock up on canned goods.
Sarah Kaplan, science writer for The Washington Post, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. And now it's time for the State of Science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
Iowa Public Radio News.
Focusing on a science story near you. And when you think of offshore wind energy, what do you picture? The ocean, right? A small wind farm maybe off of Rhode Island, large wind farms off of Norway and Denmark. But what about Lake Erie? Plenty of wind there, no doubt. And my next guest has been reporting on the progress of a project that, when completed, would be the first offshore wind facility on the Great Lakes. Andy Belaskowitz is a contributor to NCA Magazine and reporter for Midwest Energy News. He joins us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So how big is this wind project?
So, relatively small. First thing to remember about this, it's called the Icebreaker Project. It's six turbines, about 21 megawatts, which the developers say is enough to power about 7,000 homes.
7,000 homes. And what kind of potential do the Great Lakes as a whole have for wind energy?
So researchers for the past several years have been looking at the Great Lakes potential, finding out some of the best areas for doing it, and it turns out there's a relatively good supply or good areas where it could be done. So Lake Erie is one of them. Mm-hmm. Lake Michigan, sort of in the middle of the Lower Peninsula, as well as Lake Huron, sort of on the thumb of Lake Michigan. They've also found some good areas up in Lake Superior, but some other challenges there in terms of water depth and just sort of the more rugged conditions make that a little more challenging.
So which city on Lake Erie is going to be closest to it?
City of Cleveland. It'll be about 8 miles or so out from Cleveland. So standing on the shore, you could sort of make out.
And tell me why this is the first one. Why is it taken so long here?
So the history of this is pretty interesting in the Great Lakes. From what I understand, the first ideas of a project outside of Cleveland originated around 2004, 2005 by some local groups and foundations who really saw it as an economic development opportunity, and some of the challenges that city and others in the Midwest have had economically. It was seen early on as a way to sort of be a leader on this issue and with this technology. And then by about 2008, 2009 was really the height of interest. You saw most of the states that are along the Great Lakes involved in this in some way or another. Michigan, the administration under former Governor Jennifer Granholm was very active in this space, and the idea was to sort of get a policy in place that could perhaps be modeled by other states and move forward that way. However, a couple of factors, one being the 2010 election is often brought up, that sort of wave Republican election we saw in the Midwest really changed in Michigan, for example, brought in a new administration where it really wasn't a priority. At this time, several states had adopted what are renewable portfolio standards, which are basically goals down the line where you have to get a certain amount of renewable energy as part of your portfolio. The cost of onshore wind came down pretty quickly, and so that kind of became the main way to meet these goals rather than offshore wind. And so by about 2012, 2013, other states had lost interest as well, and Icebreaker just seems to be the only project that's sort of continued to chug along.
Mm-hmm. So we can, if this is, everybody will be watching this one, right? If this works, maybe more popping up.
Absolutely. I've heard, that developers in other states are interested. Certainly, even the province of Ontario, the government there is looking at this because they put a moratorium in place in 2011 to basically study the issue more after they had already moved forward with some leasing. There was some controversy surrounding that, but officials there are saying, we want to see what happens in Ohio.
Right.
And sort of another a key piece of this is, and what's sort of been holding this up a little bit is working through all the different permitting processes.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got to go, Andy. But thank you very much for the heads up. Andy Belaskowitz is contributor to NC Magazine, reporter for Midwest Energy News. We'll be back right after this break. Stay with us.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Ever argue with family members about climate change or GMOs or whether they should get a flu shot? Someone who you think doesn't have the science quite right when they formed their opinions? Well, we at Science Friday, we want to help you. We're taking this hour and talking about it, how, if not change someone's mind, to at least consider the evidence when forming an opinion. And we're rolling out a set of social media shareable fact cards. You can whip out these flashcards when you want to remind your friend of the evidence, so to speak, that global warming is not a hoax created by by the Chinese. Let me introduce my first guest, Emily Shepard, recent graduate of the Missouri School of Journalism's Donald J. Reynolds Journalism Institute. She was part of a special team that helped us build the new Science Facts resource, and you can check out some of those resources, which we're rolling out over the next few weeks, on our website at sciencefriday.com/sciencefacts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Well, tell us about this. How did this all get started?
Well, Science Facts is about putting the facts first on these controversial topics like vaccines, GMOs, climate change, just to encourage our audience members to have conversations with their friends and family about those topics. So we've curated some key facts on these complex issues, and we've turned that into information into visual, shareable elements for social media to help facilitate those conversations.
Mm-hmm. And how hard is it to convince people?
See, you know, we're really not necessarily taking the approach of trying to convince people. Our goal is really to present the facts first and kind of let them speak for themselves. You know, the data really does show, you know, all mm-hmm. of these recent revelations that, you know, we've had in the scientific community. And recently, you know, GMOs, vaccines, climate change, they've been recently politicized, but you know, we're yeah. talking about facts here. You yeah. know, it's not necessarily, you know, something that needs to be debated, but we want to give people the stepping stones to have these conversations and draw their own conclusions.
And what are some of the facts that the team chose to highlight?
Well, we've actually had some really great content produced on Science Friday shows, so we pulled a lot of our content from there. For example, the current campaign that we're working on, vaccines, we had a quote from Dr. Paul Offit talking about the different components of vaccines. So we really want to highlight these key facts that really help demonstrate the relevance of these issues and how to talk about them with people who, you know, may not have that information at their fingertips or don't understand the topics overall.
How can having better facts change the conversations we have about frustrating subjects like climate change?
You know, it's really important that we have really clear and concise information, right? And so at the Missouri School of Journalism, we really do focus on putting the factual information first. And my specialization is putting those facts in a format that, you know, can be applied to social media mm-hmm. and you know, emerging forms of media, because that social media is the place where people are having these conversations. And we want to be able to give people information so that they can share it and talk about it and give, you know, people talking points.
Mm-hmm. Well, why not teach people to argue more persuasively with people who don't believe that climate change is happening? You know, I want to prove people wrong about this, you know?
Right. You know, and Science Friday has worked with that before. It was actually a really popular How to Talk with a Climate Change Denier was one of our featured articles that we had. And that, you know, that's a component that, you know, Science Friday has recognized as well. But we found that, you know, in communicating with people who are non-believers, right, you just want to, you have to give them a morsel of information to really grasp onto, because you know, you can't argue with the facts, really. You know, the studies show, data is very, very clear. So yeah, we really are trying to emphasize these, you know, fact-based conversations.
I always try to emphasize the evidence more than the facts, because you know, everybody can have their own fact, but they can't have their own evidence.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And for example, in our fact cards, we do highlight all of the, you know, important data that helps yeah. demonstrate, you know, the relevance and the relevance of these issues.
Well, thank you, Emily. Emily Shepard, recent graduate of the Missouri School of Journalism. She helped Science Friday make its new shareable fact resources. And you can see these shareable facts at sciencefriday.com/sciencefacts. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you so much.
And in case you just joined us, we're talking about how to have a civil conversation with people who are skeptical about science. We've talked about discussing climate change and GMOs on this program, but how about vaccination? Coincidentally, do you know that today marks the 195th anniversary of the death of Edward Jenner, the physician who brought us the smallpox vaccine. And here we are 200 years later, when many parents are hesitant about the safety of immunizations or dubious about the necessity of getting their kids immunized. Only about 40% of U.S. population, 40% of the population, had received a flu vaccination by November this season. Is there a way to convince people they should still get their kids or themselves vaccinated, especially in this brutal flu season? Let me introduce my next guest. Gretchen Chapman is a professor in the Department of Social and Design Sciences at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Welcome to Science Friday. And also with me is Amanda Dempsey, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Colorado in Denver. Welcome, Amanda.
Thanks, Ira.
Well, how big is the problem of people saying no to vaccines?
Well, it's a growing problem. We know from national studies that in the past there have been about maybe 10 to 15% of parents who had concerns about vaccines such that they might not get one or more of the vaccines that were recommended for their children. And over the last decade or two, that number has grown to be more like 25 to 35% who are refusing at least one vaccine for their child. That said, though, there's a pretty stable population of the percent of people who refuse all vaccines. For the last couple decades, that's remained steady at about 1 to 2%.
Mm-hmm. And so what are the biggest reasons that people tend not to get vaccinated?
Well, there's been a lot of research about that. Some of it has come from our own work here at the UC School of Medicine in Denver. And when you look at the reasons people give for not getting vaccines, they really fall into three main categories. The first one is that they often have concerns about the safety of the vaccine. Now, whether or not those concerns are valid is a debatable point, but that's one of the reasons that they give. The second is that a lot of people aren't convinced that vaccines are actually necessary, and part of this is because vaccines have been so successful in really reducing the diseases that they prevent that a lot of people haven't had firsthand experience with, a vaccine-preventable disease that used to be really common. And then the third major issue has to do with access. So people might be interested or generally accepting of vaccines, but it doesn't take priority over other things that they might have to do in their lives that take up time as well. And so they for whatever reason, just can't get into a clinic or a doctor's office to get them.
There are people who sort of are on the cusp of these issues. I have a tweet from the Mode fanatic who says, while the actual vaccines are technically safe, I do believe the manner, meaning four in one, bundled and kids at a certain age, does have an effect on kids. Maybe people want to spread them out a little more? Have you heard that reasoning?
Yes, definitely. I'm a pediatrician, so this comes up a lot in my own clinical practice, and that is a concern that people have. But I think what a lot of people don't realize is that actually the vaccines that people who are now the age of parents might have gotten when they were children were actually manufactured in such a way that they were getting way more antigens in those vaccines 20, 30 years ago. So even though there's an increased number of vaccines, meaning more shots going into arms in this day and age, they're produced in such a way that the number of antigens that are being introduced is actually less than what we got before.
Gretchen Chapman, when doctors encounter a parent who is worried that a vaccine is unsafe for their child, what's the best way to handle it? Should they just try to tell them they're wrong?
Well, we know that physician recommendations are one of the strongest predictors of vaccination behavior. So just simply a physician recommending the vaccine is very powerful. We also know that the way that physicians recommend vaccinations are important. So a recent study shows that presumptive recommendations, so if you say your child is due for the HPV vaccination this visit, so we'll be giving it at the end of the visit. That's a presumptive vaccination that just sort of assumes we're going to do it. That's much more effective than if it's a discussive recommendation where you say, like, let's discuss whether or not you'd like to have the HPV vaccination. And so it sort of creates the attitude that, of course, we're going to do this. And then the parent has to jump in and say, wait, I'm not sure I want to do this if they don't want to do it.
So you're sort of validating their fears but telling them how to get around those fears.
Yeah, and you're communicating that this is the norm, this is what most people do, this is what I strongly recommend.
Yeah. Amanda, your research is looking at a tool for physicians to help them have better conversation with hesitant parents. What would this look like?
Yeah, so we actually did a trial here where we introduced a physician communication toolkit, and the focus was specifically on HPV vaccines, but you could really apply the lessons learned to any vaccine conversation. And we taught providers the presumptive recommendation, like Gretchen just mentioned, and then we also taught them an additional skill called motivational interviewing, which is something that's been around for a long time but hasn't really been applied to the field of vaccinations. And what motivational interviewing is basically a way of framing a conversation. It's a communication technique where you try to actively reduce people's barriers to hearing information that might be slightly different than what they think their beliefs are, and try to use people's own inherent motivation for making health behavior decisions. Mm-hmm. So we were able to teach providers how to use some of the skills in motivational interviewing to have more effective conversations about the HPV vaccine and actually increase their HPV vaccination rates for their patients.
Our number 844-724-8255, in case you just joined us. We're talking about talking with your friends about science issues, and we're focusing on vaccinations. A couple of interesting tweets came through here. Darren Sober says, the medical industry lacks credibility because of profit motives. Liz says, we have blood drives. Can we have flu shot drives? I got my flu shot 2 weeks ago. Would have gotten it sooner if it had leapt out in front of me.
Yeah, Gretchen has some really interesting research on sort of feasibility and making vaccines easier that support that tweet from the second person.
Do you, Gretchen?
Yeah, absolutely. Making vaccines the easy action to take is a very effective way to foster vaccination rates, especially among people who are generally positive about vaccinations, but maybe it's just not their top priority. They're busy. So one of my studies manipulated whether or not vaccine appointments were the default or not. The default is the thing that you get if you don't take any direct action. So some patients got a letter saying you can make a vaccine appointment if you want one, and other patients got a letter saying we've pre-scheduled you for an appointment and you can cancel it if you don't want it. And more people in that second group got vaccinated.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. A few years ago, you might have referenced this, we had Paul Offit on to talk about vaccine research. And we had a caller named Chantal who spent 8 minutes on the air. I gave her all the time she wanted, explaining how no amount of evidence would ever convince her that vaccines were safe, especially because her government was involved in the research. She said, I remember correctly, I gave her a long time to, you know, I wanted to hear what she had to say. She said, I basically don't trust anything my government tells me. Is that commonly heard, or is that, you know, something you're never going to overcome?
Trust in the vaccination system, including trust in the government that orchestrates it, is one of the main components of vaccine confidence. So that's an important part that we have to foster when we want people to get vaccinated. It's rare for someone to have that adamant of a view, but certainly it happens. And I think an interesting question is, where should we be putting our priorities in trying to foster increased vaccination? Should we be trying to convince the people who have very strident views like that, or should we be focusing our energies on people who are busy and distracted with other things and would get vaccinated if it was more convenient for them, but don't have strident anti-vaccination views.
Does it help, Gretchen, to talk about the worst-case scenarios of not getting vaccinated? For example, more than 30 kids have died this flu season already. Does this sway the hesitant at all?
Well, I do think that that's an important technique that vaccine advocates should use. That's sort of taking a page from the book from the anti-vaccination advocates, who often use very salient personal stories that are easily remembered and have a high emotional content. And I think that the people supporting vaccination can do the same thing. And unfortunately, we do have people dying from vaccine-preventable diseases. And those make very tear-jerker stories, which, you know, we could be preventing if more people got vaccinated. Mm-hmm. So let's tell those stories and hopefully convince some more people.
Let me go to Rita before we go to the break. Go to Rita in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Rita.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, my question or my comment has to do with the training of physicians to just consider some vaccinations just to be a matter of course and not allow the parent to consider that it might be something they don't want. And I feel like by doing that, it disrespects the parents. I feel like the physicians should be educators too, and that parents should be fully informed.
Yeah, so I agree with that viewpoint. I mean, parents are the ultimate decision makers for what their children get. But the reality is that there are very strong and clear recommendations that all children should get vaccinated, and it is considered the norm. So if you as a parent decide not to do that, then that's going against what is every medical organization says is the right thing to do. So what we try to train providers to do is to just reiterate that message that, you know, this is considered the standard of care. And, you know, of course, as a parent, you have the ultimate decision-making power of what goes into your children's body. And I think all providers are prepared to answer parents' questions about vaccines. So we certainly would never advocate that, you know, people withhold information. But for a lot of parents, they don't actually have that degree of concern. And so just hearing a strong, clear recommendation from their provider is enough to make them feel confident about getting the vaccines and to allay any minor concerns that they have. And so what we try to do in our trial is to start the conversation that way, but then to have providers quickly recognize if a parent does have more questions or has concerns that they want to talk about, that they have the skills and the tools to be able to address those concerns as much as the parent needs them to be addressed.
I wish we had more time. We'd talk with Rita. We have to go to the break. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more about vaccinations, all global warming, things like that, how to talk to your friends and relatives about these sticky subjects. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about how physicians can help convince more patients to vaccinate the kids or vaccinate themselves, saying this as the flu is really bad this year, but also because the U.S. continues to experience the occasional measles epidemic, whooping cough outbreak, and more. Our number, 844-724-8255. Lots of tweets coming in. Let me just read a few of them. Diane Port says, I'm 65. I have two doctors who will not administer the shingles shot. They claim they have seen patients have heart attacks. How would you address this? Other listeners want you to address how vaccines are linked to autism. Is there any evidence for that? Someone else says, we need to stop advertising any drugs and shots on TV. Big Pharma rules on all fronts. We also have some phone calls coming in. Let me go right to the phones. Let's go to Ken in St. Louis. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I really want to thank you for doing this topic. I'm a pediatrician at St. Louis University and Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital, and I do all the things that we talk about here. One thing I would like to add, though, is that it is key for me to address the fears of patients and take them seriously. It can be really frustrating to, you know, hear a patient say things that I know are wrong, and I have to remember this is about the patient. And so I'll start with, you know, the fact that you have fear about your child's safety is normal and natural and healthy, and it shows me how much you love your child. When I do that, they see that I see them, I take them seriously, and then we can have a conversation.
Okay. Thanks for calling. Good rules that this doctor's following. My guests, Gretchen Chapman, Amanda Dempsey.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, belief that vaccines are safe is part of vaccine confidence. And by and large, vaccines are very safe. For example, the belief that the MMR vaccine causes autism does not have any scientific evidence behind it. In fact, there's lots of scientific evidence refuting that association. Unfortunately, autism is just a quite prevalent diagnosis. More than 1% of children in the U.S. are diagnosed with autism, and often the first signs come around the same time that kids are getting the MMR vaccine. So there's just a coincidental confluence of getting that vaccine and then noticing signs of autism, which causes people to think that there's an association.
Yeah, And I think what that doctor did is really a key example of how we use motivational interviewing to help with this problem. He really keyed in on a motivating factor for that parent, which is, you know, being concerned about their child's health and doing what they think is in their best interest. And so there are ways to use leverage points like that mm-hmm. to get parents to see vaccines maybe from a slightly different angle in a way that they hadn't thought about before.
Now, we've been talking about how the healthcare system can better encourage people to get vaccinations, but is there a role for the rest of us, for the media, or, you know, for we all are in this together?
I think it's really important to realize that the number of people that are really completely against vaccines is very small, and the number of people that are for vaccines is actually the majority of the population. And then there's a pretty good sized group that are basically in support of vaccines but maybe have some pretty serious questions or concerns about them. And I think what ends up happening in the media a lot is that the newsworthy stories are the stories about the people who are strongly against vaccines and maybe talking about these emotional stories. And so it appears to the general public that maybe this is way more common than it actually is. We don't hear a lot of stories about people who are supportive of vaccines, got their children vaccinated, and were happy to do so. And I think it tends to undermine the message about how normative that behavior actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And vaccine success stories, by definition, just aren't much of a story. If vaccination goes as planned, the person gets vaccinated, there's no side effects, and they don't get sick. So absolutely nothing happens. It's a really boring story. But that's what we want.
Yeah. And we also don't see, you know, people in with polio lying flat for the rest of their lives inside a machine either.
That's right.
Yeah. We don't see these infectious diseases that used to be quite prevalent because guess what? Vaccination works.
Yeah. I think that's where we're going to leave it. I want to thank my guests, Amanda Dempsey, Associate Professor of Pediatrics, University of Colorado in Denver, Gretchen Chapman, Professor of Social and Decision Sciences at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. Thank you. Thank you both, doctors, for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much.
You're
welcome. Next up, with the flu season, as we keep saying, it's in full swing. Now comes word it's just not sniffles and fevers and aches and pains we need to worry about. A new study out this week in the New England Journal of Medicine suggests that your risk of heart attack can be up to 6 times higher when you have the flu, especially if you're an older person. And it's not just the flu virus that boosts that risk. Dr. Kevin Schwartz is one of the authors of that study and an infectious disease physician at Public Health Ontario in Toronto. He joins us from the CBC there. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Schwartz.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your study. How did you come to the conclusion that the flu might boost the risk of heart attack?
Sure. So what we did in this study is we looked at a cohort of patients with laboratory-confirmed influenza, and we then looked at the risk of heart attacks within 7 days of influenza infection compared to other periods of time that would be 1 year before or 1 year after the influenza infection. And what we found was, as you mentioned, that six-fold increased risk within that one-week risk period after influenza infection compared to those control time periods.
Hmm. And did you test for other viruses, too, like cold viruses, stuff like that, that might have an effect on the risk of heart attack?
Absolutely, yeah. So we did that, and that was a little bit surprising. We didn't expect to find differences for all the other viruses. We were able, with our sample size, to look at RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, and we found a significant association. Although it was lower than influenza, it was 3.5 was the increased risk. We looked at all other viruses that were not influenza and not RSV, and again, we found a significant association that was 2.7. Roughly increased risk during that risk interval. We've also looked at negative swabs, so nasal swabs tested for viruses that we did not detect any, and that's probably a mix of different conditions, either viruses that weren't tested for or perhaps bacterial pneumonias and other infectious conditions. And we also did see a significant risk, although a smaller one, for that group as well.
So how would a viral infection affect your heart?
Yeah, so good question. I mean, the leading theory is that you get this inflammatory response from influenza. That inflammation in the body changes your platelets, it changes your clotting risk, and it can precipitate clots in the coronary arteries, leading to a heart attack. We know that influenza also increases your metabolic demand. It causes your heart to race, and that stress on the body also probably contributes to somebody who's already at risk of heart attack then developing a heart attack in relation to this stressor.
So what group in the population is at the highest risk?
Yeah, so the population in this study were generally those that were at risk of heart attack. So above the age of 65 were most of them. A lot of people in the study had diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. This study didn't have the sample size to differentiate those different risks, but certainly the risk seemed higher, at least for those older in the study, but we weren't able to tease it out. But certainly those at higher risk of heart attacks are likely to be at higher risk of having one after an influenza infection.
So if it's possibly inflammation, would you taking some of the NSAIDs or the other inflammation dampening drugs be helpful?
Really good question. Yeah. I mean, we honestly don't know the answer to that. There's some data that taking antivirals and anti-inflammatories together when you have an influenza infection may improve the symptoms overall. Now, whether or not they actually would reduce an event like a heart attack afterwards is a really interesting and important question that we don't have an answer to that right now.
Mm-hmm. There was another study out this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that says coughing and sneezing aren't necessary to spread the flu. All you need to do to get the virus is to be around someone who's breathing, who has the virus. It's pretty scary. We all thought you had to be sneezed on.
Yeah, no, it's definitely an interesting study. I mean, we know that influenza is very contagious. So, I mean, that is certainly not new. I think where that study was interesting is that they looked for larger particles. And now for large particles, you need to be close to somebody, right? You need to be within probably 6 feet of them when they're projecting those particles for you to catch the infection. The study showed that even smaller particles of influenza that may float around the air at further distances are probably present. And what's interesting is it's not just from coughing or sneezing, but they're present from normal breathing. And I'm certainly not surprised by that finding. They did show in that study that if you're coughing, you are going to spread more of the virus, which is going to make it more contagious. But certainly just being near someone who is sick is theoretically possible to catch influenza that way.
Oh, like just being near somebody, not going to do it. How long does the flu virus actually hang out, let's say, on a subway pole or handle of something?
Yeah, it depends on the type of surface, but most of the time it would only be anywhere from a few hours to up to 2 days. And there's some studies showing that you can recover virus from some surfaces 48 hours after it was put there. So it is possible to get it from things like door handles and the subway for up to a couple days.
I've heard that there's something like a 3-foot rule in hospitals. What's that about? Should I start keeping at least 3 feet away from sick people?
Yeah, and that's how, you know, we tend to design where we place beds that are in the emergency room and things like that to try and prevent spread from one patient to another. And so usually most droplet spread, like how influenza and the common cold is typically spread, is going to come out of somebody's mouth with a cough or with breathing, and then it's going to fall usually within a few feet of that person. So, you know, if you're designing a hospital or you want to try and avoid catching these viruses, if you're staying within further than 3 to 6 feet away from somebody, you're certainly going to decrease the risk of it being spread.
You know, it's funny. So we did a video a few months ago about the hospital or ventilation systems. And a sneeze was a video about sneezing, and it showed that when somebody sneezes, all the droplet particles, if it's a typical ventilation system, go up into the ceiling, right into the intake of the air system for the hospital or the office, the worst place you could send it. And that's just where they tend to go. So
Yeah, it's very scary. You know, it's like movies like Outbreak that make things perhaps a little more scary than they really are. Most infectious diseases do not spread that way. I mean, there's examples like tuberculosis, measles, and chickenpox, for instance, that are very contagious. They're small droplets, and they spread through the air. So you could be in a totally other part of a room or even in a different room and potentially catch some of those infections. Most things like influenza, common colds are not as contagious. You really need to be in direct contact or within a few feet of somebody to catch those infections.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about the flu with Kevin Schwartz, infectious disease doctor at Public Health Ontario in Toronto. Let me take a call. I have a Ken from South Florida. Hi, Ken. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
It's actually Kia.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So that's okay. So last year, my son was at a friend's house who had the flu, and everywhere I was trying to get him a flu shot, all the pharmacists I spoke with, like CVS and all of them, said that they wouldn't necessarily give him the flu shot because it's not going to do anything for him because he's been already exposed. So this year, let me preface by saying I don't get the flu shot. I don't give it to any of my children. We have four. This year, unfortunately, he got the flu. And when we went to the doctor, she said that he had the type of flu that had already mutated. Like, there's no vaccination for it. He's just going to have to sweat it out or wait it out. The scary part, though, is he's an athlete, and he was having the most scariest heart palpitations, and I had never heard of that before. And then I started trying to research it and called the doctor, and they said, of course, because it affects the muscles and it affects the heart muscles. And so I'm just
curious. So you're worried. You're scared. You're worried. Let me see.
Let me see.
We don't like to talk about individual cases, but I'll see if I can get you some free medical help. Kevin Schwartz, what do you think?
Yeah, let me make a couple comments to that. So I just want to stress that we use the term flu very loosely. So often we think when people say flu, we don't necessarily differentiate between influenza infection and other viruses that cause cold and flu-like symptoms. So the influenza vaccine only protects against influenza, and it's actually very difficult to differentiate those different types of viruses without a test in the laboratory.
So.
Yeah, go ahead.
As far as she's concerned, does she have cause for worry about her son?
No, and so what I would say is the influenza vaccine protects against multiple different strains of influenza. So, for instance, like this year, there is a quadrivalent or a influenza vaccine that covers four different strains. Which is recommended for children. And so even if you've had one type of influenza, it's still recommended to get the flu shot because you're going to be protected against those other strains.
So he should get the flu shot, but he's already got some flu and she's concerned about his muscle.
Yeah, so even if you've had flu-like illness or even if you've had laboratory-confirmed influenza infection that year, there's good reason to get the flu shot that year still to protect against those other strains. And we tend to see things like influenza B come later in the year in most years, although this year is the exception to that, is that we're seeing influenza A and B come up simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. And last week, they talked about one universal flu vaccine idea, and this week there was a study exploring using nanoparticles that was very effective in laboratory animal tests. So I guess they are making some progress in trying to come up with a universal vaccine.
Yeah, this is the holy grail of really influenza vaccine development. It's been very challenging just because the part of the flu virus, which induces that immune response, is changing almost year to year, and that immune response is not long-lasting. Yeah. So it's a really interesting, I think, technology and approach that those researchers are taking to try and take part of the flu virus that does not mutate and then make it induce an immune response it's going to be long-lasting. Yeah.
Dr. Kevin Schwartz, infectious disease physician at Public Health Ontario in Toronto, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And if you want to check out any of the studies we mentioned today, we have them all linked up at sciencefriday.com/flu. One more thing before we go. It's still book club season. We're reading Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Last week, we talked about modern Frankensteins, and we received this call from Melissa, who taught the book in her English class for high school seniors.
A lot of bioethics came up in conversation, such as cloning, stem cell, and whether that would be a good idea to continue on that path with cloning, because the information gets into the wrong hands. The students felt like you could actually create a monster. The biggest thing that came out of it for my students is that it dispelled the myth. They were proud that they knew the real story.
This week we want you to tell us, was Victor Frankenstein, who impulsively creates a living being then turns his back on it, was Victor a good scientist? Why or why not? Leave us a short voicemail, 567-243-2456. Was he a good scientist? 567-243-2456. That's about all the time we have this week. You can check us out on Amazon Echo, Google Home, everywhere, every day. It's Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.